History isn't just a bunch of names and dates and facts. It's the collection of all the stories throughout human history that explain how and why we got here. Welcome to the History Unplugged podcast, where we look at the forgotten, neglected, strange, and even counterfactual stories that made our world what it is. I'm your host, Scott Rank. Hey everyone, Scott here. Welcome to the History Unplugged podcast. This is a special episode if you happen to be watching. If you're just listening on a normal audio podcast on Apple Podcasts or Stitcher or whatever, this is normal. But this is the first episode where I'm doing video along with audio. Some people like to watch on YouTube or other video platforms, so I'm making that option available now. And if you go to YouTube and look for History Unplugged Podcast, that's where you'll find it. This episode is about India. It's not just India, but the enormous influence that India had on the West, how it created in the Western imagination this land of exotic wealth, how India inspired the Age of Discovery because people were seeking out this wealth, but also how there is a long history of contact between India and ancient Greece, the Roman Empire, and the contact between these different cultures created hybrids. It led to things like the rise of Buddhism. It led to the proliferation of science and mathematics. The numbers that we call Arabic numerals are actually from India, although they came to Europe by means of Arab scholars, so that's why we call them Arabic numerals. Let's start at the beginning. The idea of India in ancient Greek geography is the basin of the Indus River, which corresponds to modern-day India and Pakistan today. And for somebody in ancient Greece, India was on the extreme eastern fringe of the known world. For the ancient Greeks and Romans, India was thought of as all territory beyond Arabia and Persia. And you could reach India if you were from Greece. They vaguely knew of China, but nobody really went to China from these lands. If there were any goods that went from Greece or Rome or somewhere in antiquity in Europe to China, it was never by one person. It was passed off by intermediaries. And we do know that goods did reach China and even Japan in the ancient world. I have a podcast episode about this, but this had to do with trade networks, not one person that we know of. The first detailed accounts of what the Greeks knew about India appear in the history of Herodotus, who lived from 480 to 425 BC. And this became part of the Western imagination almost up to the period of Vasco da Gama. Marco Polo writes more detailed notes about India, but he still stuffs them with all sorts of legends that come from the ancient world. India is thought of this fantastic land full of wealth. For example, Herodotus claims that there were gold-digging ants that were the size of foxes or even dogs, and they would unearth gold dust when they were digging their mounds and tunnels, and people living in the province would collect the dust. The reason that he can make a claim like this and people would believe it is because fantastic wealth does come from India. Gold, spices, fabrics and cloth, silks, other things. If not coming from India, at least pass through India on the Silk Road. So that's why people would believe there's so much wealth there. It's these claims of wealth that led Europeans through the centuries to seek trade directly with India. And it was enough to convince Christopher Columbus to sail west across the Atlantic and reach a direct out, even though other navigators at the time said that his calculations were terrible and he and his crew would starve at sea. His calculations were wrong, but through serendipity, he lands on the New World. And he believed that for the rest of his life that this was, in fact, India. For that reason, the name Indians stuck, and American Indians and other indigenous groups in the New World still are called this. So India was an exotic land in the Western imagination, but through different cultures coming together and meeting here, there is this incredible Eastern-Western synthesis. Buddhism came out of this mix, or was at least jump-started by it. The early Christian heresy of Manichaeism came out of it. And for the two cultures, India represented the farthest terminus of civilization that one person could travel to and safely return. So today's episode is about the impact that India had on Western civilization and how the quest for India led to incredible long-distance travels for traders. There were colonies in India, especially on coastal cities, where there would be colonies of Greek traders and later Roman traders. So today, the way that you have a little Italy or a Chinatown in different American metropolises or metropoli, you would have Greek town or Roman town or whatever they would call it in cities in India, and you would hear Greek being spoken there. The idea for this episode actually comes from listener Jeff Mitchell, who says, "A question I've been pondering over is to what extent did cultures from the Indian subcontinent, the Indus Valley have or influence Western civilization. Marco Polo, Alexander the Great's journey into this part of the world. But the historical knowledge seems very light in discussing the civilizations and cultures. Well, I'm going to get into all that in this episode and talk about how the connections between India and the ancient Western world. And when I say the ancient West, I'm just broadly referring to ancient Greece, the city-states there, Greek traders, Greek travelers, and later the Roman Empire. So that's the catch-all term I'll be using there. And how they have these connections, and it's not something that has to wait until Alexander the Great or Marco Polo. It happens much earlier. So I'll talk about the first Greek traders that arrive in India in the 6th century BC, then the Greek and Roman colonies in India, the Indo-Greek kingdom that's left behind after Alexander the Great's conquest, and what it was like for Greeks to live in India, and then as they intermarry into Indian culture, what does this offspring culture look like? And it does a lot. It helps spread Buddhism. I'll talk about medieval travelers that come to India, such as Marco Polo. And finally, Vasco da Gama, who creates a direct link between the two cultures of India and the West, and it lasts up until the modern era today. So among the non-European lands most known to medieval people, India was probably the most important. Europeans got most of their knowledge about the Indies from the remnants of Greek learning, which had eroded over the centuries since the end of the classical period, but had survived in some of the Latin works that were being transcribed and copied in medieval monasteries. Earthly paradise was reputed to exist in or near India. Stories about Alexander the Great were particularly popular. They were handed down from the classical period. And Alexander famously traveled all the way to India in his pursuit of power and lands. And many manuscripts describe his battles and adventures in India, going up against war elephants and everything else. Our first full account of India in the West comes from Herodotus. He describes India, he calls it Hindike, Chore, it's the Roman transliteration, meaning the Indian land, named after Hindus, which was the old Persian name of the Indus River and the associated satrap of Sindh in the Achaemenid Empire. Darius the Great had conquered parts of India in 516 BC. At the same time, the Greek colonies of Asia Minor in western Turkey had been part of the Achaemenid Empire since 546. So Greeks and Indians first came in contact with one another because they were both subjects of the same emperor. And depending on how possible it was to travel within the Iranian or the Achaemenid Empire, you could go from Greece to India. And that's something that usually brings people in contact with one another when they're conquered by the same person. This is why Marco Polo could travel all the way to China when he did, because he traveled through the Mongol Empire, and it was safer at that point to travel than it was any other time. When you leave one empire and exit another, that's dangerous because people might wonder, are you an enemy? Are you a spy? It's much more likely to be killed if you're crossing empires than just traveling to one empire. Now, Herodotus writes about India, but there are those that went before him, and this is getting more into legends. According to Herodotus, Skylax of Karyanda was a Greek explorer who sailed down the length of the Indus in the service of Darius. He did this around 500 BC, and he wrote a geography about the peoples of India. Now, we don't have his complete work left behind. All we have are extracts of it that appear in later works. And this is how a lot of ancient writings come down to us. There are many ancient writings. We don't have the full extant. We just have little excerpts that appear in later writings. What we do know about him is that Skylax of Karyanda was a Greek explorer and writer of the late 6th and early 5th centuries BC. He was from Karyanda, which was a small city on an island close to Iasos in Asia Minor, modern-day Turkey. He was probably an ethnic Karyan, and he might have been familiar with Greek and used it in his writings. We don't know very much about him, except for a few fragments of information relayed by later Greek writers, and this could have been legends that they made up. Herodotus called him a sea captain from Ionia, and he sailed down the Indus River at the behest of the Achaemenid Emperor Darius I, because he was his subject, and then around the Arabian Peninsula to reach the Suez. Here's what Herodotus has to say about him. Darius was the discoverer of the greater part of Asia. Wishing to know where the Indus, the only river with crocodiles, save one, probably the Nile he's talking about, wishing to know where the Indus ran into the sea, he sent a number of men on whose trustworthiness he could rely, and among them, Skylax of Karyanda, to sail down the river. So it's sort of like a Lewis and Clark expedition of the Achaemenid Empire. They set out from the city of Caspitris in the region called Paktia and sailed downstream in an easterly direction to the sea. Here they turned westward, and after a voyage of 30 months, reached the place from which the Egyptian king sent the Phoenicians to sail around Libya. And I talked in a previous episode how the Phoenicians may have circumnavigated Africa. They at least traveled far down the west coast, And there's good reason to think this is true because they're describing things like the going across the equator. They're noticing different constellations, which you would when you're getting into the southern hemisphere. Thus, all Asia, except the eastern section, has been found to exhibit the same features as Libya. So there's a lot of questions that have been raised about this narrative. The city of Caspitris and the country of Paktika haven't been traced to any real locations. We don't know if Herodotus was saying something that he heard and writing it down, but doing a poor job of transliteration. Maybe he was confused about a certain place. Maybe he heard a legend from someone and couldn't separate legend from fact. Assuming that it's somewhere in the vicinity in India of Gandhara, which was under the control of the Achaemenid Empire, it's unclear how Skylax was able to assemble a fleet of vessels in this landlocked country. Also, the Indus doesn't flow east, but in a southwesterly direction. So some commentators have doubted if Skylax's journey ever took place. But we do have excavations at the Suez, which seem to corroborate his account, and Darius's later acquisition of control over Sindh. And scholars have various explanations for these questions. David Bivar, historian, has noted that Caspitrius was written by the later Greek writer Hecatios as Caspapyrus, and both the names seem to have been misspelling of Pascapyrus, a Greek spelling of the name of Peshawar. So Skylax is presumed to have started by sailing east along the Kabul River and turning south after it merges with the Indus River. The idea that the Indus flowed east may have been a misunderstanding by Herodotus of its source. So scholars say that Skylax's expedition wasn't only for exploration, but rather for reconnaissance, a scouting party for future conquest by Darius. And hey, why can't it be two things? No reason why not. According to Matthew Criss and Grant Parker, Herodotus presents geographical curiosity as a feature of foreign kings, particularly when they plan conquest. Others have characterized it as a spying expedition. 30 months is a long time for it to last, but if they had enough provisions by the king or enough gold and able to buy things from neighboring groups there or friendly traders, it very well could have gone along that long. And they could have lived off the land, since if they were traveling by river, there would have been a lot of cities or settlements or trading ports here. So it'd be much easier to stock up on provisions than any sort of overland expedition. Anyway, soon after the purported date of this expedition, Darius seems to have added it to his empire as a new province called Hindus. It was referred to as India by Greek writers. And we don't know the extent of this province because whenever Greek writers are talking about India, the dimensions are very hazy. We can't really get locked down on geographic borders closer with a few hundred miles in certain areas, especially when they're talking about the eastern end of India. Herodotus' description of it is lying to the west of the desert, Thar Desert, that basically limits it to the middle and lower Indus Basin. We also have an inscription by Darius talking about the completion of a canal connecting the Nile with the Red Sea, and he states this in an inscription. I commanded to dig this canal from the Nile to the sea which goes from Persia. Afterwards, this canal was dug, thus as I commanded, and ships passed from Egypt by this canal to Persia, as was my will. So afterwards, oceanic communication between India and Persia, as well as Egypt and the Mediterranean, were established and maintained for some time. Due to Darius's conquest and his infrastructure projects, it's now easier for people to travel from Greece to India or from Western Achaemenid Empire to the Eastern Achaemenid Empire. And that's where you see this Greek city-state be established. All right, now let's talk about the legends that Greek writers made up when they would hear accounts about India from secondhand information. And then we're going to get into the first real interaction that Greeks in the ancient world have with India. And that has to do with the conquest of Alexander the Great. So what those in Greece know about India is based on secondhand accounts and hearsay, like what Herodotus has. It's only after the conquest of Alexander the Great and the emergence of the Indo-Greek kingdoms that are left behind after his conquest that the Mediterranean world has firsthand knowledge about the region. Conversely, Indians also became aware of the existence of Greeks during this period. By the 3rd century BC, Eratosthenes recognized India as terminating in a peninsula, the shape that we know that India is now, reflecting a grasp of the geography of the Indian subcontinent. Instead of just placing it generically at the far east end of Asia and where the known world sort of ends and dithers offward into nothing. Eratosthenes was also the first Greek author to postulate an island at the far south of India, later known as Sri Lanka, and European knowledge of the geography of India didn't really become much better until the end of antiquity and remained at this stage until the Middle Ages. And then with the Age of Discovery, India becomes much better known. So these accounts are being written at this period with the conquest of Alexander, really the best knowledge of antiquity in Europe until centuries and centuries and even millennia later. Let's look at the Indo-Greek kingdom. In 326 BC, Alexander conquered the northwestern part of the Indian subcontinent as far as the Hyphasis River and established satraps and founded several settlements, including Bucephala. He then turned south when his troops refused to go further east. Alexander also established several colonies in neighboring Bactria. After Alexander's death in 323 BC, Bactria came under control of Seleucus I, Nicator, who founded the Seleucid Empire. The Greco-Bactrian kingdom was founded when the satrap of Bactria, Diodus I, seceded from the Seleucid Empire around 250 BC. The Indo-Greek kingdom, or sometimes called the Greco-Indian kingdom, covered various parts of northwestern and northern India, and it lasted from about 180 BC to about 10 AD. So a very long time this Greek civilization is distinct from the rest of India. This kingdom, the Indo-Greek kingdom, was founded when the Greco-Bactrian king Demetrius invaded India in 180 BC, created an entity that seceded from the powerful Greco-Bactrian kingdom, centered today in Bactria, or northern Afghanistan. The term Indo-Greek kingdom describes a number of dynasties, and it had numerous capitals, but the city of Taxila in northern Pakistan was probably the earliest seats of the local Hellenic rulers. During the two centuries of their rule, the Indo-Greek kings combined Indian and Greek languages and symbols, and you can see that on the coins that they minted, and they blended Greek and Indian ideas. And you can see this in their archaeological remains, the type of architecture they used, the type of gods that they worshipped. And the diffusion of Indo-Greek culture has consequences that are still being felt today, particularly through the influence of Greco-Buddhist art, where Greek themes are found in the iconography of Buddhism. Even the ethnicity of the Indo-Greek people can be seen today. According to the Greek writer Polybius, now, something we don't know is how long the Greeks managed to maintain a distinct presence in the Indian subcontinent. And what I mean by that is, how long did they have a culture that was seen as being distinct from India? Think of immigrant groups in the United States. After two, a maximum of three generations, they really lose any sort of distinct accents. They forget languages that were spoken in their home countries, and they become completely assimilated for all intents and purposes in the United States. The same process happens with the Greeks. Although in the ancient world, the process of assimilation is much, much slower, and sometimes it never happens because you don't have anything like national schools or places where children go to learn the main language. The presence of government is much smaller, so your local community is going to have far more impact on your customs and your language and your traditions than your empire would be. So that people could come from Greece, settle in India, and maintain a distinct culture for three centuries isn't really that surprising. So the language of Greek was used for centuries, the calendar methods, and the Greeks may have maintained a presence in the cities until quite late. Isidorus of Charax, who's writing in the first century, describes an Alexandropolis, a way to describe a Greek city, the metropolis of Arachosia, which he said was Greek even at that late time. He said, "Beyond is Arachosia, and the Parthians called this White India. There are the city of Beet, and the city of Pharsana, and the city of Chorokod, and the city of Demetrius, then Alexandropolis. It is Greek, and by it flows the river Arachotis. As far as this place, the land is under the rule of the Parthians." Okay, so let's talk about relations between India and the Roman Empire. Indian religion probably influenced Manichaeism. It was one of the great heresies of the early Christian church. Its founder, Mani, traveled to India and included the Buddha alongside Jesus among his divine beings. And if you ever see writings of the church fathers, they almost always include heresiologies. They're talking about Donatism, Gnosticism, and Manichaeism is almost always included in there. It's a contribution of India. By and large, Indo-Roman relations were built on trade. Direct government diplomatic relations were very weak or non-existent because between them you had the Persian Empire or the Parthian Empire. So trade meant going around the Red Sea, going around the Arabian Peninsula, and then arriving in India. Roman trade in India began with overland caravans as well, and later by direct maritime trade following the conquest of Egypt by Augustus in 30 BC. According to the Roman geographer Strabo, Not long after Augustus took control of Egypt, when Gallus was prefect of Egypt from 26 to 24 BC, up to 120 ships were setting sail every year to modern-day India. And here's what he writes. There's a whole lot of streaming services available these days, but what you probably don't know is with most streaming services, you're missing out on a whole universe of international shows that typically aren't available on them. That's why it's time to break the domestic TV bubble and check out Acorn TV. Acorn TV is a commercial-free streaming service rooted in British television. It has top-rated mysteries, dramas, comedies, and historical period pieces, like Miss Fisher's Murder Mysteries, which follows a woman in 1920s Melbourne doing the work of a private investigator. And if you're a fan of British comedy, and I am, especially The British Office, then the other one is for you. It follows two sisters from different worlds who have no idea the other existed until their father drops dead. If you're a Downton Abbey fan, the other one features Siobhan Finneran. Acorn TV is loaded with thousands of hours of binge-worthy content, and you can stream it on all your favorite devices for just $5.99 a month. Escape to Britain without leaving your seat. Try Acorn TV free for 30 days by going to acorn.tv and use my promo code UNPLUGGED. That's ACORN.TV, code UNPLUGGED, to get your first 30 days free. At any rate, when Gallus was prefect of Egypt, I accompanied him and ascended the Nile as far as Syene and the frontiers of Ethiopia. And I learned that as many as 120 vessels were sailing from Myos Hormos to India, whereas formerly, under the Ptolemies, only a very few ventured to undertake the voyage and to carry on traffic in Indian merchandise. Augustus maintained the Ptolemaic Red Sea ports and the service from the Red Sea to the Nile, where goods could be carried downstream to the ports of Pelusium and Alexandria. And he also replaced the Ptolemaic patrol fleet on the Red Sea to keep piracy in check. He received embassies from Indian kings in 26 and 20 BC. It's not as if there was a permanent embassy, the way that we think of diplomats today who live in a foreign country. It's more like a group or a retinue will arrive and then they'll talk with leaders there and then they'll leave. So it's haphazard. It's not set up on any regular schedule. It's only really done whenever it's possible. And if at home your government falls apart, then, well, you could be stuck. There's very little known about these embassies, but one account says these missions were certainly intended for something more than exchange of empty compliments. They wanted to set up trade negotiations, maybe even talk about military alliances and other speculations. By the time of Augustus, if not before, a sea captain named Hippolus claimed he had discovered, or perhaps brought news, that it was possible to travel to India safely and punctually by leaving from the Gulf of Aden on the summer monsoon and returning on the anti-trade winds of winter. This would be made safer and more convenient by the Roman sack of Aden in a naval raid in the year 1. Cassius Dio, who wrote in the 3rd century, said the following. Many embassies came to Augustus, and the Indians, having previously proclaimed a treaty of alliance, concluded it now with the presentation, among other gifts, of tigers, animals which the Romans, and, if I mistake not, the Greeks as well, saw for the first time. Well, the Greco-Indo kingdoms would disagree with that, but that's at least what he knew of. Overland caravans could gain more convenient access to India after the expansions of the Kushans into northern India during the 1st century, and then down into the Ganges Valley in the early 2nd century. Cassius Dio writes, from those land routes, at least in the time of Augustus, several embassies reached Rome. What we know about land routes from India to Rome is that likely several embassies reached Rome in the time of Augustus. Four are mentioned in the Latin literature by name, including the embassy from Peru country, which took with it to Rome serpents, tigers, and a letter written in Greek. Second, the embassy from Broch, which was accompanied by a Buddhist monk named Germanos. Third, an embassy from the Chera country, and it was reported in Rome that at Muziris, near Krangahor, was built a temple in honor of Augustus. And the final embassy was from the Pandya country, which brought with it precious stones, pearls, and an elephant. So at the time of Augustus, commercial relations between India and Rome grew, but in this balance of trade was in favor of India from the very beginning. And as a result, Roman gold pours into the country. We have another account of Roman-Indian relations called the Periplus of the Erythian Sea, written by an anonymous sea captain, and it was written in Greek. And it's dated sometime between the years 40 and 70. It's a Greco-Roman pamphlet written in Koine Greek, the common Greek language. It describes navigation and trading opportunities from Roman-Egyptian ports along the coast of the Red Sea and others along the Horn of Africa, the Persian Gulf, the Arabian Sea, and the Indian Ocean, including the modern-day Sindh region of Pakistan and southwestern regions of India. So the text has been ascribed to different dates between the first and third centuries, but the most common one is the first century due to the way that the language is being used. It's a firsthand description by someone familiar with the area, and it provides accurate insights into what the ancient Hellenic world knew about the lands in and around the Indian Ocean. And here's an excerpt from it. Beyond the Gulf of Baraka is that of Baryagaza and the coast of the country of Ariaka, which is the beginning of the kingdom of Nambanus and all of India. That part of it lying inland and adjoining Scythia is called Iberia, but the coast is called Syrestine. It is a fertile country, yielding wheat and rice and sesame oil and clarified butter, cotton, and the Indian cloths made therefrom of the coarser sorts. Very many cattle are pastured there, and the men are of great stature and black in color. The metropolis of this country is Minagara, from which much cotton is brought down to Baryagaza. So under the Western satraps, Baryagaza was one of the main centers of Roman trade on the subcontinent. And this work, the Periplus, describes the goods exchanged. There are imported in this market town wine, Italian preferred, also Laodicean and Arabian, copper, tin, and lead, coral and topaz, thin clothing and inferior sorts of all kinds, bright colored girdles, a cubit wide, storax, sweet clover, flint glass, gold and silver coin, on which there's a profit when exceeded for the money of the country, and ointment, but not very costly and not much. And for the king, there are brought into these places very costly vessels of silver, singing boys, beautiful maidens for the harem, fine wines, thin clothing of the finest weaves, and choicest ointments. There are exported from these places spikenard, costus, ivory, agate, corellian, lycium, cotton clothing of all kinds, silk cloth, mallow cloth, yarn, long pepper, and such things that are brought here from the various market towns. Those brought for this market town from Egypt make the voyage favorably about the month of July, and that is Epiphi. So in this work, you're not going to find a lot of detailed accounts about what people did, their customs, their religion. It reads like an import-export duty list. This man is interested in trade and what goods can come to and come from India. Well, he was a trader, so that makes a lot of sense. Well, probably the most important account that we have about India and its trade with Rome that has survived the classical period is from Pliny the Elder, writing in 77. And he gives a lot of detail about India. Not all of it is accurate, but his descriptions give us a lot more detail and they fill in the blanks there. He says, coral is as highly valued among the Indians as Indian pearls. It is also found in the Red Sea, but there it is darker in color. The most prized is found in the Gallic Gulf around the Stoicades Islands, in the Sicilian Gulf around the Aeolian Islands, and around Drefnum. Coral bellies are no less valued by Indian men than specimen Indian pearls by Roman ladies. So this was a valuable object of conspicuous consumption, these Indian items in Roman society. Indian soothsayers and seers believe that coral is potent as a charm for warding off dangers. Accordingly, they delight in its beauty and religious power. Before this became known, the Gauls used to decorate their swords, shields, and helmets with coral. Now, it is very scarce because of the price it commands and is rarely seen in its natural habitat. So Pliny the Elder estimated the value of Rome's trade to the east at some 100 million sesterces a year. This could be an exaggeration, but it just shows how much goods are traveling between the two empires. He says, for example, just one documented consignment from Musirius, which is in modern-day southern India, to Alexandria, consisted of 700 to 1,700 pounds of nard, which is an aromatic balsam, over 4,700 pounds of ivory, and almost 800 pounds of textiles. This has been calculated as worth a total of 131 talents, enough to purchase 2,400 acres of the best farmland in Egypt. That's a lot of money for one shipment. When it is borne in mind that an average Roman cargo ship would have held about 150 such consignments, and this is a historian commenting on Pliny here, Pliny's figure becomes entirely plausible. With such staggering profits, it is a little wonder that the Roman government in Egypt encouraged and profited by the trade. A 25% tax on all goods from India was levied by the Romans at the Red Sea port of Lus Khome. And we have a lot of other accounts about India. Some of them come from military commanders. Some of them are descriptions of military campaigns. We have one from Emperor Trajan, who in 105, he defeated the Dacians and he annexed the Nabataean Arabs centered in Petra, which is modern day Jordan. And he returns to Rome where, according to this account, ever so many embassies came to him from various barbarians, including the Sindhi, the people of the Indus Valley, present-day Pakistan, and he gave spectacles on 123 days, in the course of which some 11,000 animals, both wild and tame, were slain, and 10,000 gladiators fought. Trajan later defeated Parthia, the Parthian Empire, and he sailed down the Tigris River, reaching the northern shores of the Persian Gulf. He had a dream of repeating Alexander the Great's march to the northwestern subcontinent, but he eventually turned around due to his age. And there are lots of other accounts, sometimes legendary, of the influence that Rome left behind in India. For example, a medieval copy of a 4th or 5th century map of the world shows a temple to Augustus at Musirius, remember, in southern India, one of the main ports for trade to the Roman Empire. This and evidence of agreements or loans between agents. So this all points to a Roman settlement in the region. Musirius was a key city. It was a key to the interactions between southern India and Persia, the Middle East, North Africa, and the Greek and Roman Mediterranean region. It's sort of like Constantinople. It's just, it's so many crossroads that you can't help but have a lot of cultures interacting there. So I talked about the goods that were brought out from India in Musirius. In terms of what the Romans brought to India, they brought gold coins, thin clothing, figured linens, multicolored textiles, copper, tin, lead, coral, raw glass, wine. And trade declines from the 5th century onward due to the collapse of the Western Roman Empire. But the former Musiris attracted the attention of other nationalities, especially Persians, the Chinese, and Arabs, due to their connections to so many different cultures and what they could bring in as a trading group. And embassies of Indians continue on through the Roman Empire. According to Eusebius of Caesarea, embassies arrived from what they called Indians of the East at the court of Constantine, Emperor Constantine. And this account says, ambassadors from the Indians of the East brought presents, which they presented to the king, Constantine the Great, as an acknowledgement that his sovereignty extended to the ocean. They told him, too, how princes of India had dedicated pictures and statues in his honor in token that they had recognized him as their autocrat and king. I don't know if that's true or not, but Eusebius definitely knows how to flatter the emperor. And more embassies are mentioned from what are called the Indian nations in the year 361. So at this point, the capital of the Roman Empire would have been relocated from Rome to Constantinople. Embassies from all quarters flocked to him, the Emperor Julian in the year 361. The Indian nations vying with emulous zeal in sending their foremost men with presents as far as from the Divi, the Maldives, and the Serendivi. And the best archaeological record of Roman presence in India is found at Archimedes. Archimedes was a Tamil fishing village that was formerly a port dedicated to bead making and trading with Roman traders. It flourished until about the 5th century, and a number of Roman artifacts have been found here in archaeological excavations, pottery with Latin and Greek written on it. So it supports the view of a huge amount of trade, perhaps even more than we realize today, between Rome and Tamil. All right, so for this final section, what we're going to look at is how knowledge of India is lost in the West, in Europe, with the fall of Rome. The legends that they have in the Middle Ages are mostly from writers like Herodotus and Strabo, and how India is rediscovered during the Age of Discovery, and why it's really India that inspires it and inspires Europe to travel around the rest of the world, really laying the foundations for the modern world today. Knowledge of India was never lost in the West, but in the Middle Ages, direct communication was rare. Much rarer than it was during the Roman period. So the fantasies and facts of the Greeks and Romans remain the principal knowledge of India. A few scholars in the Christian West remained aware of the civilization in India, and there's a monk in the 7th century writing of the Indians' subtle discoveries in the science of astronomy, of their rational system of mathematics, and their method of calculation. And we have a tract in the Syriac language written in the 7th century about the Indian numeral system. So these numbers eventually come to the Middle East, and over a much, much, much long period of time, really to the High Middle Ages and later, Arabic numerals finally take hold. But it takes a long time for the transmission of this information to get from India to the rest of Europe. And there were stories of a great Christian king somewhere in India based on rumors of the ancient Christian church of Kerala. And there were a lot of Nestorians and other Christians that did live in India and along the Silk Road and even up into China. And there's a curious development that happens in the later Middle Ages as there is information of India that makes it back to the West. Monsters and demons and even the devil in the Christian tradition begin to be identified with Indian gods. A lack of understanding about the religious structure in India is something that Christians are confused by, and they associate different Indian gods or goddesses with different demons that they know of. So Indian gods being maligned as monsters become a staple of the Western imagination. The greatest account, of course, in the Middle Ages of what we know of India comes from Marco Polo. They claim to see a number of monstrous people and animals and cultural practices. They are actually providing firsthand accounts, but then they are also weaving in secondhand information, kind of like Herodotus, and totally fantastic accounts and monsters and stuff like that. In the medieval period, the Polo family were among the greatest European travelers in Asia. Marco Polo journeyed to China as a direct consequence of an earlier stay there by his father Niccolo and his uncle Maffeo, who set out to Constantinople. Marco Polo journeyed to China as a direct result of his family staying there earlier, his father Niccolo and his uncle Maffeo, who had set out from Constantinople in 1260 on a trading route in the Crimea. They then joined a caravan traveling along the Volga River to the capital of Barka Khan, who was the ruler of one of the daughter states of the Mongol Empire as it was breaking into smaller empires. He was a grandson of Genghis Khan. In 1262, they got stuck in the region because of war. And while biding their time there, they received a request for an interview from the great Kublai Khan, who had never met any Europeans before up to this point. He then tasked them with taking a letter to the Pope, asking for 100 educated Christians to be sent to the court as missionaries. Although this account is a little bit disputed because some say that they were there to convert them to Christianity. Others say that that's more wishful thinking of medieval and Renaissance Christians, and they simply wanted Western educators. So anyway, Kublai Khan tasked him with taking a letter to the Pope, and the only people nominated to return with them to the court of Kublai Khan refused to go. So instead, they took Marco, who was 17 years old at the time, and he didn't return to Venice for 24 years. In his book called The Travels of Marco Polo, he describes the marketplaces he traveled to in terms of the strangeness, the business customs that he sees, saying that the people are unreasonable and difficult to understand. Hey everyone, Scott here. One more brief word from our sponsors. He accused the Brahmin population of superstitions regarding the belief that business decisions could be influenced by the direction from which tarantulas enter a room. And in one of the strangest moments of his account, he expresses delighted bafflement at the use of paper money at the Khan's court. So he has bits and pieces of accounts of India, but the absolute watershed moment that is a break between the ancient world and the modern world when it comes to relations with Western Europe and India are the travels of Vasco da Gama. Vasco da Gama circumnavigated Africa. He went around the Horn. He arrived in India, and he made it possible for Portugal to set up different trading posts along this route so the Portuguese could have direct access to India. I did an earlier podcast episode talking about how much did it cost to send a pound of cinnamon from India to Europe in the Middle Ages. A long story short, due to the dozens of hands that it trades when it goes from India to Europe along the Silk Road, and each merchant taking their cut of the merchandise, by the time spice would go from India to, let's say, England, a pound would be more valuable than gold. So that's why in the Age of Discovery, travelers who are willing to circumnavigate Africa on a very dangerous mission and reach India or other places to access spice markets, if they return to Europe with their vessel laden down with spices, it's more valuable than transporting solid gold. That's why they were willing to undergo these dangerous voyages, and that's why India looms so large. The imagination is, if you can arrive in India and you see merchants selling spices for cheap, it's like going there and they're selling gold for pennies on the dollar. I mean, you have a license to print money if you can make it to India. So what I want to do is read the account of when Vasco da Gama arrives in India, because it's very interesting, and his first exchanges with the ruler there, and how do you converse with someone when you don't speak each other's native language? How do you go about establishing meaningful communication with groups that have been cut off for centuries and centuries? So when Vasco da Gama reached Calicut, later Calcutta, on the southwestern coast of India in 1498, he was able to report that India lived up to the expectations that Europeans had held about it for centuries. They found large cities, large edifices, and rivers, and great populations among whom is carried on all trade in spices and precious stones, what he writes. So this was the beginning of European imperialism in India, and the Portuguese established themselves at coastal ports,